Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow afternoon at Carthage College, a guest speaker is going to be making a presentation that promises to be quite interesting. The title of the talk really says it all: Religious Literacy, Religious Liberty, and the Bible in American Public Schools. Actually, that's probably a misnomer. The title doesn't say it all, but it certainly gives us a sense of sort of the breadth and scope of this of the topic to be addressed and its importance for so many Americans. And the guest speaker who will be talking on this topic is Dr. Mark Chancy, who is professor of religious studies for Dedman College of Humanities and Sciences at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. And he will be making that long journey to Kenosha to be on the Carthage campus to talk about some really complicated and important issues, and I dare say some issues that are also rather emotionally charged for many people who care about such things, often sort of to the core of their being. And it's maybe one means by which we can sort of come to terms with the very different ways in which different people might approach such matters. And I'm really grateful to Professor Chancy for making time in his busy schedule to allow this conversation about tomorrow's talk. Professor Mark Chancy, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you very much. It is really a pleasure to get to talk with you and to visit Carthage College. I'm looking forward to it with great anticipation.
Very good. Could you just say a quick word about your own interest in religion and just a brief word about sort of the life's path that has taken you to where you are now?
Sure. Thank you for asking. My training is in biblical studies. I'm a professor of New Testament studies and early Judaism, and much of my teaching and writing has revolved around the world of early Judaism and early Christianity, especially in relation to how archaeology illuminates that world. That's one reason why I'm so excited to come to Carthage College, because it has a very well-known and respected excavation in northern Israel that I have followed for years. Along the way in my career, I began noticing a topic that seemed to be understudied, and that was the topic of religion courses in public schools, by which I mean K through 12 schools. I had never realized before that some public schools offer distinct courses that are devoted to the Bible, and I found that fascinating. Now, it was no secret. These courses are taught here and there, at least, in almost every state in the United States, but they were understudied and no one had ever examined them. And I noticed them because of a controversy out in West Texas in the small town of Odessa, Texas. Now, most people, if they know Odessa, they immediately think of Friday Night Lights, football, the television series, the book. It's that Odessa.
Wow.
Yes, well, football is not the only religion out there.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because actually a few months ago I had the privilege of interviewing Buzz Bissinger, the author of Friday Night Lights, the I believe 25th anniversary of its initial publication passed recently, and the book was re-released in a new edition. So I had the great privilege of speaking to him about that book and about Odessa, Texas. And now here's another way in which Odessa, Texas is on the map. Please tell us more about the controversy that erupted there.
Well, what Serendipity? You know, that is such a classic book about football culture and about Texas culture and its veneration of football. What drew my attention was the other religion, which in that town is overwhelmingly Protestant Christianity of different varieties. A group of parents decided that they wanted the public school in Odessa to start a Bible course. They wanted the high schools there to offer a four-credit course on the Bible during the school day. And they chose a particular curriculum that was produced by a religious organization that often is lumped into the broad category of the religious right or the Christian right. So this was a very theologically conservative organization, a socially conservative organization, and an organization that very much thinks its goal is to restore America to what that group sees as its Christian roots. So this is not a pluralistic, diverse vision of American identity. This is a particular religious understanding of American identity. So that group had a Bible curriculum that it assured the school district was completely religiously neutral, had been vetted by academics, had never been taken to courts, and that the school could safely use without any worry of lawsuit or controversy. And there was a parent in Odessa who began looking into the curriculum and realized, you know, this does not look religiously neutral. This curriculum seems to promote, sometimes in subtle ways, sometimes in not subtle ways, certain religious viewpoints over others. This is religious preferentialism in school. This is using tax money and public resources to promote one group's religious views over everybody else. And then he said, you know what? The parent who objected, he said, my daughter's Jewish. There aren't many Jews out here in Odessa, and my daughter already gets bullied at school. People ask her why her people killed Jesus. They ask her, why can she not be a Christian? And the parent said, if this course enters this high school, my daughter's life, I think, could get even worse because of the values this particular curriculum promotes. I'm going to fight it.
Mm.
So he threatened a lawsuit. And for his efforts, he got death threats. But this drew a fair bit of media attention, and it caught my eye in the newspaper. And I said, well, this is interesting. I didn't know you could do this. And then I saw the reference to this particular curriculum they were using, and I started trying to find out about it. And I discovered there was very little written on it. You couldn't get it. You couldn't order the curriculum from Amazon. You couldn't find it in libraries. They wouldn't send out exam copies. So it took quite a bit of work just to get a copy of this controversial curriculum, and I opened it up and looked at it, and it was just a jaw-dropper.
Hmm. So the concerns of this parent, as far as you were concerned, were right on the money.
It turned out that that was indeed the case. And, you know, it could have been otherwise, right? I mean, it could have been that I opened up the curriculum, and it had an even-handed overview of Scripture that mentioned various viewpoints and didn't privilege one over the other, and that highlighted what's undeniably the Bible's importance in culture and literature and music. Could have been all of those things, but it wasn't.
Hmm.
You know, instead, it was the presentation of a particular strand of Christian theology as the normal way to read the Bible. And mixed in with it was quite a bit of factual errors, sometimes even to the point of urban legends. So the most famous example that comes out of that is when the textbook said, well, science has proven the complete accuracy of the Bible in every regard. Scientists are in agreement that everything that's in the Bible actually happened the way the Bible describes. And then it went on so far as to say, you know the story in the book of Joshua where the sun stands still? Well, NASA has found a missing day in time that corresponds to the biblical story of the sun standing still.
Hmm.
Well, this is an urban legend, right? This never happened. But the book could not tell the difference between urban legends and mainstream scholarship. And, you know, to boot, dozens of pages were cut and pasted off the Internet, and it was selling up for $150. So, long story short, the school district ended up dropping that curriculum. There was a mediated settlement outside of court, but it ripped apart the social fabric of that community, and it got me completely hooked at both the importance of biblical literacy. I teach about it. I think it's very important, but also the difficulty of promoting it without also promoting somebody's religious views over others, and that becomes a matter of religious liberty.
Right. I'm curious about this particular case in Odessa, and I suppose there have been others like it, maybe not around the same exact specifics, but similar sorts of lawsuits brought. What would the legal basis be for such a lawsuit? In other words, what law is being violated or potentially violated, for instance, with a public school adopting a curriculum such as this?
That is a great question. So here is how the legalities of it all play out. In 1963, a case went to the United States Supreme Court, and that case was primarily about school-sponsored Bible reading. So here we have to imagine what used to happen in much of the country, not all of the country, of every morning the teacher reads, say, 10 verses from the Bible to the class, or the teacher appoints a student to read 10 verses, either in homeroom or at morning assembly or over the intercom. So here you have a captive audience of school kids, and again, tax-supported public money being used to promote particular religious views. And so when that went to the Supreme Court in 1963, the Supreme Court said, you know, that's government establishment of religion. That goes against the First Amendment. That goes against the religion clauses in the First Amendment, the provision against the government establishment of religion. You can't have that type of school-sponsored Bible reading in public schools that are supposed to be for everybody and that are funded with tax money.
Hmm.
But the court was very, very explicit to say, it's perfectly acceptable to study about religion. Knowing about religion is really, really important. In fact, here's the quote from the court ruling. It might well be said, the justice writing the opinion said, it might well be said that one's education is not complete without a study of comparative religion or the history of religion and its relationship to the advancement of civilization. And then the judge went on. It certainly may be said that the Bible is worthy of study for its literary and historic qualities. Nothing we've said here in the ruling indicates that such study of the Bible or of religion, when presented objectively as part of a secular program of education, can't be done consistently with the First Amendment. So the court said, you can study about religion. You just have to present the material objectively. And that's what has proven difficult to figure out how to do, is that objective presentation that's even-handed to different religious groups. So when there are controversies, the legal basis is bound up in case law that goes back to this Supreme Court ruling that says you can teach about religion if you do it objectively, and that's grounded on the religion clauses of the First Amendment. There can be no government establishment of religion.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Chancy, professor of religious studies at Dedman College of Humanities and Science at SMU. He's going to be speaking at Carthage College tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 on the topic that we're talking about in this portion of the morning show, namely the place of biblical study in American public schools. Does it belong there? And if so, what is the appropriate way for that to be done? The name of his talk tomorrow, Religious Literacy, Religious Liberty, and the Bible in American Public Schools. Professor Chancy, how many court cases actually have there been like the one you were just describing in Odessa, Texas? I mean, are they relatively commonplace at the moment?
I would not describe them as commonplace, right? How many there have been sort of depends on how we define our terms. But, you know, let's say about 10, right? The first one that comes along is in 1971 in Virginia. Then there is another one in the late 70s that lasts for a couple of years in Tennessee. Then there are several in the 80s, one in the late 90s, one in the early 2000s. So again, depending on how we parse it out, let's say about 10 that are most important for this. So it's not the case that they're happening every day. Usually what happens is if there is a controversy, either the school district will find a curriculum that's more acceptable to people, or the school district will back down, or the people in the community who are objecting will end up not filing a lawsuit. And there might be multiple reasons not to file that lawsuit, but not least is the fact that people who challenge these sorts of courses in court often end up on the receiving end of death threats. And that is a pretty persuasive reason not to file a lawsuit.
Right. So what has been the primary focus of your interest in this? What facets of this have been most intriguing to you and have sort of drawn your professional academic attention the most?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the driving questions that I've been working with, and I've been working on this since 2005, is to try to offer some constructive solutions on what the type of study of the Bible that the Supreme Court mentioned might look like. And I was very fortunate that there have been people who have talked some about that. For example, some folks at the First Amendment Center had done some work on that. There was certainly a lot of work by scholars in the 70s and 80s back then trying to outline what that might look like. My contribution has been to look at what is actually taught in particular curricula and in particular classrooms to see how it meshes with the various guidelines that have been developed. A lot of what had been talked about was in the abstract, and talking in the abstract is very different than, for example, looking through hundreds of pages of course materials from particular courses. So I've tried to flesh out some of those things. You know, what would a course look like that met the court's requirement for objective and non-sectarian? Well, for starters, it would talk about the fact that there's not just one Bible, but there are many Bibles. Jews have a Bible that's different from Roman Catholics, whose Bible is different from Protestants, whose Bible is different from Eastern Orthodox churches. So we start off talking about the unique features of different Bibles. A course that was more religiously neutral would be intentional in exposing students to different translations. Sometimes particular translations are associated with particular religious communities. The one that jumps out most in American history is the King James Bible. It's a distinctly Protestant version, but it is often what's used in classes as the default translation, and that ends up inadvertently privileging Protestantism. Sometimes it's basic stuff. Public schools should not treat the Bible as a science book, as a science textbook. Most don't, but some do. How to treat Judaism. The courses that succeed best are the ones that treat Judaism as a religion in its own right, and not just as a foil for Christianity, or as the background for Christianity, or preparation for Christianity. So that's been some of the sorts of issues that I've tried to engage with. But I'm interested in the politics of it. I'm interested in the history of it. I'm interested in the human drama of it all. Very sincere people, passionate in their convictions, wanting what's best for their families, wanting what's best for their communities, and having completely different takes on what the best is.
Hmm. Has your interest taken you so far as to, in effect, construct such a curriculum that would, in fact, be appropriate?
You know, what we have done is I'm a member of the Society of Biblical Literature, which is the principal professional society for biblical scholars. It is a big tent society, meaning it's open to biblical scholars across the religious spectrum, religious and secular, regardless of tradition. It's the whole collection of biblical scholars. And there are several of us who are experimenting with what such lesson plans might look like. So we are working towards that goal in the planning and experimentation stages.
As I think about this issue and topic, kind of with, somewhat to my surprise, one of the things I'm thinking about is the experience that I had as a college freshman, actually at a church school, at a church college, church-owned college, the first time I took a religion course, I mean, an introduction to religion course, and I was really not ready for what that was going to be like. And for all the respect that I have for those three religion profs who team taught this course, I do have to say there were ways in which I thought they were a bit insensitive to somebody like, and you know, I would not, you know, put myself religiously then or now in the camp of some of the people we're talking about in Odessa, Texas, for instance. But on the other hand, I wasn't ready to listen to somebody talk about the Bible in a sense in such cold, clinical terms. That was really shocking to me and sort of shook my foundations. And I'm not even saying it shouldn't have happened. I mean, in many ways, I'm glad it happened and so on. And I emerged kind of on the other side of it with my faith intact. But I do feel like, certainly at the moment, in the moment, I felt like they could have shown more sensitivity to the typical 18-year-old believer and been more aware of the way in which they might really be shaking somebody's understandings of the Bible right to their foundation, and doing that somehow in a way that isn't quite so painful or bewildering in the moment. But maybe that's something that cannot be avoided if that's in fact what the course is and what you need to do. I wonder if you've thought very much about that, even beyond the specifics of what such a curriculum should say. You know, maybe the question of how it should be said and the way in which it can be sensitive to that young student taking a course like that and maybe thinking about the Bible like that for the first time in their lives.
You know, and you are not the only person to go through college to have had that type of experience in a religion class, right? We can all think of stories either in our own experiences or those of people that we know who, if they went to college, they might have run into that. As well, hopefully, as stories of people who encountered teachers who were much more sensitive. I think you've really identified an important issue there, which is the necessity for teacher preparation, both pre-service, before they get into the classroom, and in-service, the normal training they receive along the way to stay up to speed, on how to handle these matters in a religiously sensitive way. To do this successfully in a way that does not generate conflict requires learning to be respectful of diverse religious sensibilities. And it's a different context in the high school room than it is in the college room, especially in the public high school, right? In the public high school, it's a captive audience. It's folks from all sorts of backgrounds. There are political dimensions in terms of local politics that college professors don't have to worry about. There are legal dimensions in a public high school that college professors don't have to worry about. And so tact and sensitivity is essential. And I think what that means is that a good, solid high school, public high school Bible course is not always going to look like a standard college-level intro. Right, there are questions you can press at the college level that are appropriate, age-appropriate, educationally appropriate, contextually appropriate, that are counterproductive at the high school level. So it's finding the balance between, yes, academic quality and learning to push students while being respectful of their different sensibilities. Mm. That's actually a really tall order. If you think about it.
It really is.
Wow. That's what makes this so fascinating. That's a lot to ask. especially since a lot of the times teachers who teach this haven't had any academic coursework in biblical studies or religious studies themselves. Some teachers have, but a lot of teachers who offer these courses have not, I've discovered. It is a lot to ask of them.
One specific matter, I think, that is a point of special concern and sensitivity is the whole matter of inerrancy, the fact that there are quite a number of Christians who have been taught and who embrace the Bible for its inerrancy. And I think that can be one of the most frightening things that can happen in such a course, is for that matter of scriptural or biblical inerrancy to perhaps be called into question. Do you see that as an appropriate facet of biblical literacy in this kind of setting?
You know, these courses are usually taught in either social studies contexts or English language arts contexts. And if they are taught in a social studies context, then it's inevitable that historical questions are going to come to the foreground. One way to handle that is for the teacher to be sure to talk about the fact that different religious groups have different perspectives. And when something comes along that relates to a historical question, to say, you know, there are some religious groups, and name them, and you might say, you know, certain conservative Protestants who believe in inerrancy, who would insist that all of this is historically accurate, just as it says. They could then say there are other groups that choose to differ, that leave questions about this. If it's something in the New Testament, then it's always safe to say, you know, Jews certainly don't see this as inerrant or even inspired, right? This is not even their scripture. Different communities have different positions on that question, and you should know that. And then the teacher doesn't have to resolve it. Simply alerting the student to the fact that already there are different communities with different perspectives, I mean, that has the civic value of making them think of the fact that, wait a second, different religious groups see this differently. In some ways, it's easier to do in an English language arts context, because then you can focus in on character, plot, themes, setting, irony, and you can deliberately sidestep the sorts of issues that become flashpoints in the controversy over inerrancy or not.
Hmm. So in your mind, this is one crucial matter for instance, a school district to think about, is the placement of such a course within a particular academic department.
I think that's true. That's true. Which one is going to work best for that community? And for which type of course do they have a teacher who's best prepared in English language arts or in social studies? And knowing the dynamics of their community, what can they imagine conflict points being, and how can they anticipate and maybe avoid those? I think placement and categorization is very important.
Hmm. How much of your work has involved talking with more conservative Christians, such as, for instance, those in Odessa, Texas, who would have supported the course that was ultimately withdrawn from the school there? How much direct interaction have you had with that particular population in terms of learning more about their perspective on this and their potential receptiveness to the kind of biblical study that you are describing here, that in your mind is a more appropriate model? I mean, by and large, have you found receptiveness to that idea, or more suspicion?
You know, most of my direct encounter with some of the groups promoting these courses, particularly the group behind the curriculum that Odessa favored, has been looking at their own literature. So looking at their textbook, following their blog postings, reading their newsletters, tracing their history, reading news articles about them, listening to their radio show appearances, things like that. And for some of the individuals and groups, I've developed a pretty close familiarity with where they're coming from. And so this holds true for some of the groups that I've studied. It's not universally true. Some of them really do want to use these particular courses to promote their own religious views over everybody else's. And that's just the bottom line. And so they are not interested in the more even-handed approach that I and others have talked about. So, and I want to be clear, when I talk about the even-handed approach, I am not suggesting that people create classes that are somehow antagonistic towards those religious sensibilities. I'm just talking about creating courses that are sensitive to a broader range of sensibilities rather than just promoting one or the other. But there are other groups that very much are trying to come up with the same sorts of project that I'm talking about, that are working on materials, that do teacher workshops, that see it as a goal. So, you know, there are multiple groups involved coming at it from multiple perspectives. I would say that much of my work has not been well received by groups like the one behind the Odessa curriculum.
To what extent do you sense school districts as a whole shrinking away from having anything like this in their curriculum, out of probably well-founded fears that that such a course might stir up controversy, otherwise, either by being too tightly focused and in a sense partisan, upsetting, you know, one kind of citizen, versus being too sort of open-ended and, let's say, liberal, upsetting citizens on kind of the other side of the aisle. I mean, how many school districts are presumably not going anywhere near this out of fear of upsetting somebody or everybody?
I think that's why most school districts don't offer something like this, right? There are enough of these courses to notice and be interested in, and there's a push to increase the number, to be sure. But the reason that push to increase these courses hasn't been more successful, I mean, you've just nailed one of the main reasons. They are such potentials, they raise such potential for controversy that many school districts end up avoiding them altogether. Now, some school districts choose to offer them and create masterful courses that are actually really effective. So there are some success stories out there, too, and that's important to hear. There are teachers that hit home runs with these courses. But certainly I've seen more than one district consider it and run away as fast as they could. And that holds true not just for Bible courses, but also for, say, courses that are world religion surveys. Right. There are some of those out there. There aren't as many as might be expected. Why is that? Because of the potential for controversy. The other reason that these courses aren't more common, and I think this is important to note also, is with the increased emphasis on standardized testing as the measure and the focus in the curriculum on certain areas that can be subjected to standardized testing. There's not always as much room in the curriculum for electives as there used to be. So electives have often been crowded out in favor of what are seen as the basics.
Mm. Boy, that is a double whammy, isn't it, in terms of crowding this off to the side?
Yes, indeed. Right. Yes, indeed.
A last question. I think one matter that is particularly a source of particular concern when we were talking about, for instance, conservative evangelicals, is that they often hear rhetoric from kind of the other side of the spectrum that essentially kind of says, you should just believe what you want to believe and what makes sense to you. And, you know, if you want to be Christian, that's fine. And if I want to be a Hindu, that's fine. And if this person over here wants to be Buddhist, that's fine. And it's just important that everybody finds the thing that makes the most sense to them and helps them understand themselves and the world better and so on. But essentially, describing all religions as of equal worth. And of course, if you are on that side of the spectrum, that makes perfect sense. There's no other way to see the world. But if you happen to be somebody for whom you are a Christian, not just because that happens to be what you chose, but because you believe that is the path of truth, and you believe it's the path of truth for everybody, even if they don't know it yet. But I mean, when it comes to that particular matter, then it really becomes very tricky to talk about religion in kind of a pluralistic sense without, in a sense, getting right at the heart of what is so fundamental to the way that they understand their own religion. Is there a way around that? Because otherwise, it seems to me that is going to always be a perpetual source of really difficult tension.
My own response in thinking about that, a very, very insightful observation, right? Given that for many people, their religion is a source of exclusive claims. I think that these views that I believe, that they are right and correct and have existential and eternal significance in being correct. And rather than educational authorities or scholars talking to those groups in a K-12 context and suggesting, well, all religions are the same, work it out, find your own thing, they're all equal. Rather than talking about truth claims that way, I would reframe it just in terms of getting along with each other in the public square. Groups have different beliefs and practices. People have different convictions. That's their right to do so. We don't have to agree with those beliefs and practices, but in a pluralistic democracy, we do have to respect each other's right to have them, and knowing something about them will help us all to get along better. But learning about them does not mean you have to give up your own deeply felt convictions. It's a matter of learning how to get along with your neighbor.
Very well said. And when one thinks about what role a public school plays in our collective life as a country, that's probably one of the most important roles that it needs to play and should play.
I agree. Absolutely.
Dr. Mark Chancy is going to be speaking at Carthage College tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 p.m. in the Todd Weir Center in a talk which is open to the public. And the title of the topic, again, of the talk is Religious Literacy, Religious Liberty, and the Bible in American Public Schools. Professor Chancy, it's been a great pleasure for me to speak with you today on The Morning Show about this really interesting and complicated topic. And I hope many people will seek out the opportunity to experience your talk in person tomorrow. In the meantime, safe travels to you, and thank you again for being part of The Morning Show today.
Thank you. The pleasure was all mine. Thank you.
I suspect that some of you have heard at least a little bit about a remarkable book, soon to be a remarkable motion picture as well, based on a story at NASA of some black women in an era when such things were quite uncommon, all but impossible, in fact, were mathematicians behind the walls of NASA and making a very, very significant difference at NASA during some crucial years in America's development of its aeronautics industry. The book at hand is Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. The author is Margot Lee Shetterly, and She is an Alfred P. Sloan Foundation fellow who has also done extensive research on the place of women in computing. And she happens to have grown up in Hampton, Virginia, which is the location of the Langley Aeronautical Library, where these women did their important work. Margo Lee Shetterly, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, and good morning to everyone.
I'm excited to be talking with you about this remarkable story. I think I am like most Americans, knowing nothing about this story until the emergence of your book. You knew something of their story, of course, because you had the pleasure of knowing some of these women there in Hampton, Virginia. Tell us first where your personal connection began with them and how you came to know their story.
Right. Well, my personal connection really began with my family. My father is a retired research scientist. He worked his entire career at the NASA Langley Research Center. He started working there in 1966, so really, you know, during the height of the civil rights movement, during the height of the space race. And but here in Hampton, Virginia, there was a community of people of all backgrounds who were engineers, who were scientists, who were mathematicians. Many of them were women, and many of that group of women were African-American, among those the women that I write about in my book. So I was very fortunate to grow up in a place where I got to see African-Americans and women of all backgrounds working and succeeding in the science field, and not think of that as something particularly unusual.
Mm. What really was the catalyst for these particular women becoming part of NASA was actually something which occurred over wide fronts during the Second World War, where so many men were called to the field of battle or called to be part of the military, even as scientists and in other roles, leaving gaping voids that in some cases had to be filled. And so this goes beyond the iconic figure of Rosie the Riveter. These are women stepping into voids that were essentially left in our aeronautics industry. Tell us about the transaction which allowed this to take place and what these women were doing at the time that this, in a sense, summons came from NASA.
Right. Well, women have always been interested in math. I think there's a misperception about women and their mathematical abilities. But women who were good at math and who had studied math usually became math teachers. They put their degrees to use in the classroom. And then during World War II, just as you said, there was a tremendous demand for labor. There was a tremendous demand for aeronautical research. You know, planes had become this important agent of victory for the war. Like, this was changing the course of World War II. And so there in Hampton, they needed all hands on deck. They needed all of the mathematical computing power to do that research, to make the planes safer, make them fly faster, make them go longer distance without needing fuel. And what they needed were computers at a time when a computer was a person who was simply a job title, usually a woman in those days, who computed. So I think it's hard for us sometimes to remember just how transformative World War II was, and how many things that we take for granted today happened during World War II. But one of them was that women were able to step into jobs that were previously allocated only to men and get a foot in the door and prove themselves. So this was certainly true of the entire group of women, and it had particular resonance for the African-American women who faced barriers not just because of their gender but also because of their race.
Right. And, of course, one thing that is maybe a bit uncommon about this particular story is that in so many cases, women who were given these exciting new opportunities during the Second World War found themselves shoved aside. Not in every case, but in many, many cases, shoved aside once the war was over and life returned to some semblance of normalcy. But in this case, these women were doing great work at NASA and were allowed to continue that over the course of decades.
That is very true. And, you know, it's true that there were some cutbacks. You know, I look back at the records and the employee newsletters, and they talk about the cutbacks, and, you know, the war is over, and we're going to have to reduce our force. You know, but in the end of the day, even as World War II trailed off, there continued to be this demand for aviation. You know, planes, we take planes for granted. We go to the airport, we get on the plane, we don't even think about it. But, you know, planes really transformed in so many ways our modern life. And so, you know, as the continued demand for faster planes, for military planes, for supersonic aircraft, all of that continued through the late 40s, throughout the 50s, the Cold War, and then the space race. And all of those things require mathematical support. You know, you can think of these, think of all the things that we do with our computers today, all the analysis, all of the computing. We rely on them so heavily. Well, these women provided that kind of support to that highly analytical work that was being done there at Langley and at other NASA centers across the country.
As we mentioned, Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory is located in Hampton, Virginia. Virginia would have been a Jim Crow state with Jim Crow practices in place, Jim Crow laws in many cases in place. And one of the most poignant things about your book is the discussion of what that was like to for these women to be working in a place like NASA, couched in a community where black and white were very much separated. And talk for a moment about that particular facet of this story and how important it was to tell that thoroughly.
Yeah, so the thing about it is they were, as African-American women, they lived in a worked in a separate workroom. They had separate bathrooms. They had a separate cafeteria. You know, all of those things applied to them within the center, even though they had this new job that previously hadn't been open to them before. You know, it's a painful part of the history, you know, but it is a part of history. So we have to look at the thrilling parts along with the really painful and difficult parts. And they were truly patriotic, you know, despite that Jim Crow segregation, they never stopped working on behalf of the United States government, on the mission for NASA, for, you know, getting American soldiers and pilots into planes that were safe, and eventually sending astronauts into space and landing them on the moon and bringing them home safely.
And one of the most moving aspects of this whole story is the fact that these women have not seemed to be all that interested in accolades. In fact, I'm curious to what extent they were receptive to the idea of their story being told in this way.
Well, you know, you ask them over and over again, what do you think about this this sort of new light that's being shined on you and the work? And they, almost to a person, they say, you know what, I love my work, but at the end of the day, I was just doing my job.
Mm. The book, again, is Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. And the book is by Margot Lee Shetterly, soon to be a major motion picture. Margot Lee Shetterly, thank you so much for writing such a fascinating book and joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you for having me on. It was a real pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be previewing for you the world premiere that is occurring this weekend of a brand new opera at the Milwaukee Florentine based on the very important novel Sister Carrie. We'll be talking to the composer, the librettist, the conductor, and two of the singers who are in the Florentine's cast. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Wednesday, we'll be speaking with Kelsey Molinari, a harpist, who is the current artist in residence for the Racine Symphony and performing with them this weekend. We'll also preview for you Carthage's latest theatrical production opening this weekend called The Invisible Hand. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You find the program archived on our website, wgtd.org. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More